7.5 FM, W298DK Amory, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Chuck Sievertson. U.S. stock markets taking a hit after a 1-2 punch, a disappointing jobs report, President Trump's new tariffs. ABC News senior White House correspondent Selena Wang.
American businesses say they're already paying the price. Ford estimated the tariffs will cost the company $2 billion this year. Procter & Gamble, which makes everything from toothpaste to detergent, says it's raising prices on one quarter of its products, passing some of those tariff costs on to consumers.
President Trump saying he's moving two of America's nuclear submarines closer to Russia in response to a top Russian official, Dmitry Medvedev, who warned the U.S. leader not to play, quote, the ultimatum game with Russia. President Trump's special Mideast diplomat Steve Witkoff met today in Tel Aviv with hostage families calling for an end to the war in Gaza and their loved ones' return. No arrests a day after a shooting that left four people dead at a bar in Anaconda, Montana. This is ABC News. Smoke from Canada leading to trouble, says ABC News forecaster Samara Theodore.
Air quality alert right now for places like Minneapolis, Green Bay, Omaha, Kearney, Cedar Rapids, and all the way as far as east as Detroit. Now, as far as this continuing to thicken up, that's going to happen as we head through the remainder of the day. Those Canadian fires are burning and smoke really billowing farther south, headed into parts of the Great Lakes, into Green Bay, Detroit.
The wait, physically, not emotionally, on back-to-school students brings tips from ABC News medical contributor and pediatrician Dr. Alec Patel on packed backpacks.
Padding helps. Sometimes a waist strap can be a good idea as well. And most people don't pay attention to this. A backpack should be about 15% of a child's body weight. So for an 80-pound child, that's about 12 pounds. I know it seems like a small little detail, but it can make a big difference when it comes to keeping those necks, heads, and backs healthy and focused.
Chuck Sievertson, ABC News.
This fall, there's only one place to be, Camp Randall Stadium. Wisconsin football returns with can't-miss matchups, including Maryland, Iowa, Washington, and more. From the first touchdown to jump around in the celebration of the fifth quarter. Experience the traditions and unforgettable memories that make Wisconsin football so special. Single-game tickets are now on sale. Lock in your spot today by visiting uwbadgers.com or call 1-800-GO-BADGERS. Wisconsin football game day starts here. We'll see you at Camp Randall.
Mornings with Pat Kreitlow.
It's fun to look back and laugh now.
That was a bad day.
There are marriages that have died on less. Our first actual fight as a married couple was about the house rules of playing Monopoly. We've not really played Monopoly since. When you can modify an app, you can modify the rules of the game. Maybe there are times when you are better off just playing the computer. Play something else with your spouse instead.
Mornings with Pat Kreitlow. Weekdays 6 to 9 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. Download the Civic Media app in the Google Play or Apple App Store and take us everywhere. This is the Civic Media Radio Network.
Talk about, you know, since Trump and the Republicans passed that one nightmare of a bill, basically proving what I've said for the long time, that the people who wear their religiosity on their sleeves, yeah, not. And the people who tell us how pious and how faithful they are, yeah, not. And look, I don't ever want to hear from another conservative about how much they love the Jesus and how much they care about the children and any of that stuff. Because the proof is in the pudding. It's in their policy. And I've been saying for years that my liberal friends, my progressive, religious, faith-based folks should be the ones stepping forward and fill the space that's been left void for far too long. Now, I do know there are progressives of faith and liberals of faith, even though our mainstream corporate-controlled media likes the narrative of the faithful are only, you know, those folks, the people who took food out of the mouths of children. And as I've been thinking this through and talking with my friends of faith, going, you know, what are you going to do? I know that you're not the kind of folks who want to go out and proselytize. I know you're not the folks who like me, don't pray in public. One of the most disgraceful things I've ever seen was that image of a bunch of Republicans in a circle, their little prayer circle, you know, praying for your strength or whatever, or just giggling that they were going to make poor people's lives worse. the spectacle. And I've seen this in restaurants where, you know, someone's got to get up and everyone's got to make a big scene of, hey, look at us. And yet those are the same people who would literally take food out of the mouths of children. So for me, it's a moment of people of faith. Please, it's time to start talking about social policy that we need to be marching towards. We need a social safety net again. We need just immigration reform and policies to bring families together. We need a progressive tax code so that we can encourage the kind of economic justice that I believed in growing up as a kid. Peace and social justice is how I grew up. We need to be pushing for climate change legislation, environmental protections, and we need to fully fund public education, public health care. There's a lot to be running on, to be running for. And to stand up to the people who have kind of claimed that they're the one religion. And understand, you know, people of faith need to organize. We need to have faith-led advisory campaigns against the harm that's being done in the name of religion. We need to build coalitions across faiths and fight for those things that the Jesus would have been in favor of. You know, feeding the hungry, caring for the sick, caring for the elderly. You know, those things that seem to be, well, not as important anymore. And I'd like to see, you know, because understand, I have a lot of religious conservatives who tell me government shouldn't do anything. Charity is in the house of the Lord, and churches should be feeding the hungry and caring for the sick and doing all this stuff. And I'm going, yeah, should be. Why aren't you? We give you tax breaks. Why aren't you? Why do we still have hungry? Why do we still have homeless? If there's so many good conservative Christians who believe this, why aren't we doing more of it? And for me, this is where I say we can solve all of these problems, but we do it through our government. We do it through the largest body in this country that can eradicate poverty, that can make lives better. But for most of my religious conservative brethren, that's not how it plays out. And for all of the good intentions, for all of the folks who tell me how wonderful their faith is, I come back to show me. Show me how strong this is. Show me that churches can do this. Because no one's stopping them. Government doesn't stop them, except in places like Texas, where feeding the homeless is a crime. But again, done in the name of Republican ideology. I'm curious, my left-leaning religious folks, what do we do? How do we get there? How do we get to a place where the words of Jesus are what we do? I mean, if we're going to use religion and politics together, how do we get there? Quick break, right back.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So earlier in the week, we talked with a representative of the Catholics Vote Common Good group about their work, and you know, I enjoyed it so much. I said, you know what, maybe we reach out to another representative, another co-chair of the group Catholics for Common Good. Their website, votecommongood.com. Because look, I think this is one of those areas that Democrats, that liberals, that progressives, this is one of those battlegrounds that kind of people need to pay attention to, because unfortunately, the narrative in this country is that the religious people are on the right, that the Republicans represent religion in this country because they keep spouting, we're a Christian nation, while doing all kinds of, well, anti-Christian stuff. And here to share some thoughts on, well, what that means, what the Catholic Church is doing, and what the parishioners are doing, I've asked Patrick Carolyn to come share some thoughts. He's a co-chair of Catholics Vote Common Good. You can check out their website, votecommongood.com. Patrick, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here, Rick.
So as I said, look, the narrative has been that, you know, the religious folk have all gone over to the Republicans, all to the right, all to the prosperity gospel folks, and that all that's left on the other side are a bunch of godless heathens. Am I getting anything wrong?
Well, you're getting a couple things wrong. First of all, I'm not a godless heathen. I'm still consider myself very Catholic, and I also consider myself a social justice Catholic. You're right about the fact that at least in the last couple of elections, or not the last election, the Catholics and Christians in general moved over to Trump. Something to keep in mind is in this country today, 21% of the voters still self-identify as Catholics. That's a lot of voters. That's a lot of people. And in key battleground states like Michigan and Pennsylvania, Wisconsin and Arizona, it's more like 27-28% that self-identify. The Republican Party understands this. The Republican Party spends millions and millions and millions of dollars to go out after these voters, to talk to them, to meet with them. The Republican Party has training sessions for people running for office on how to talk to faith voters, and in my case, particularly Catholic voters. The Democratic Party doesn't do anything. The Democratic Party in its last election didn't spend any money to reach out to Catholic voters. They hired a young guy. He did the best he could, but he was doing Catholic voters as well as three other groups, I believe. Now, in 2016, in three key battleground states, Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin, Donald Trump got 65% of the white Catholic vote in those three states. In 2020, Joe Biden won the Catholic vote in those three states. So you think that the Democratic Party would have understood the importance [S2] Yeah. [S1] Of that. And another point about it is that since Richard Nixon, every president that's gotten elected has gotten a majority of the Catholic vote. So again, you would think that the Democratic Party would understand, and yet the Democratic Party doesn't have a single person on staff whose responsibility is to do Catholic outreach. They don't spend any time at all. And, you know, I don't know if you've had a chance to talk to Doug Padgett from Vote Common Good, who works a lot with the evangelicals. He's a wonderful person to talk to. His organization did a survey, and not only did his survey find that Catholics and Christians, you know, were sort of moving, but they felt that the Democratic Party was anti-Catholic, anti-Christian. And that's despite the fact that, you know, we have people like my good friend, Congresswoman Rosa DeLauro,
right.
AOC, Congresswoman AOC, who I've heard both of those people and others speak passionately about their Catholic faith and how their commitment to justice comes from their Catholic faith. But the Democratic Party, they don't get it. Now, let me just say, some 20 years ago, and I want to make sure I get it right, so I'll read what he actually said. Then Senator Obama said, he said that it was in 2006, and he said, building a covenant for a new America means that the Democratic Party has to take seriously the need to better understand and reach out to faith voters, and warned of dire consequences if they do not. That was in 2006. And unfortunately, the Democratic Party didn't take his
advice. Yeah, but Patrick, you know, I said that back in 2005.
Well, yeah,
I've been saying that most of our lives because like a lot of people, I think the Democrats took faith voters as they've taken labor voters kind of for granted.
Yes.
Because understand, look, I grew up in the Catholic Church, and it was at the time, you know, 70s, early 70s, it was all about peace and social justice. We had priests walking the picket lines.
Yes.
So, you know, it was a natural marriage between, you know, those communities and the Democrats. And somehow, I don't know if it's just taken for granted or what, but somehow they've kind of lost it.
They have. And, you know, if you go back and trace the history, and you go back to Pope Leo, I believe it was the 13th. I can't remember if we're in the 14th or 13th now. But he wrote an encyclical. And this is back in 1890, 1895. He wrote an encyclical in which he talked about the rights of the workers and the need for the workers to join forces with as part of their Catholic faith. And that began the beginning of this movement of the labor and Catholic coming together. And that's what helped get the New Deal passed. It's what helped get Franklin Delano Roosevelt elected president and a number of other people elected presidents. And then at some point in time, the Democratic Party decided they didn't want the Catholic Church. They didn't want the Catholic Church, but the Catholic voters. I'm a very activist. I've run for public office as a Democrat. I think the Democratic Party shows an anti-Catholic bias. I think they show it by the fact that for Kamala Harris's campaign, they hired a 22-year-old kid who had no experience organizing, had never worked in Catholic world, and that's who they were going to have be the outreach person for the Catholic.
But let me ask you this, Patrick. Is it bias or is it stupidity and apathy?
It's stupidity.
I tend to go that way. See, I'm not going to go with the bias angle because that's what the right keeps telling me. That's what my evangelical crowd keeps saying. Well, the reason you lost faith voters is because you're with those people. And you put those people into a basket of any faith that's not Christian, anyone who does something that the extremists think is somehow morally wrong, you know, same-sex marriage, you know, trans things, any of that stuff. So is it that there's bias or they're just plain stupid about it?
I say they're stupid for sure. If you look at the data and if you look and see that, again, since Richard Nixon, everybody who's gotten elected president has gotten a majority of the Catholic vote. If you didn't get a majority of the Catholic vote, you didn't win the election. You would think you'd want to spend a lot of time and energy. Now, the Republican Party understand that and have understood that for years. They spend millions and millions. And, you know, there's people like Timothy Bush and Peter Thiel and Frank Cannon and others like that. That just contribute millions of dollars to far-right Catholic organizations to reach out to Catholic voters. And I'll give you an example of it. And I know everybody talks about abortion, and, you know, abortion's the issue. So Kamala Harris was asked a question, and she was asked, do you believe that a woman should be able to have an abortion right up until the time she's delivering the baby? And her answer was, and by the way, Hillary Clinton was asked that exact same question in 2016, and she kind of gave the same answer. Kamala's answer was, I support Roe versus Wade. Now, right after that, millions of Catholics across the country got emails, phone calls, letters, editorials were written that says the Democratic Party and Kamala Harris believe women should have a right to have an abortion right up until the moment they're giving birth.
But that's not what Roe versus Wade gave them.
It's not exactly Roe versus Wade. You're allowed to, under Roe versus Wade. I mean, what that person was asking Kamala could have happened. You could have a ban on partial birth abortion. You could have a ban on late term abortion under Roe versus Wade. That's the answer Kamala Harris should have given. And let me say, I think if we had a referendum today on abortion, And the referendum was, you know, 22 weeks, up to 22 weeks. There's no restrictions after 22 weeks for medical necessity, things like that. Yes, but beyond that, no. And it included increased funding for maternal and child health programs and family leave policies and free birth control. I think that would get about 70% of the vote in this country.
Yeah.
Because we're not as split as people make us out to be.
No, look, you bring up an interesting point, because the reality is I think Democrats have done a horrible job on messaging on a whole bunch of things.
Yes. Yes.
And talking especially to working class voters. Now, me, yes. as somebody who grew up Catholic, you know, I don't talk about this often, but I'm personally not in favor of abortion for me personally. But as an old white guy, probably not going to have one. I would prefer my wife not to have one. But it's still her choice. I come down on the pro-safety part. I've got two daughters. I want them to be safe. I don't want them to have to live through what their grandmother's generation lived through, because my mother had a friend who died from a botched abortion because it wasn't legal in Ohio at the time. So, you know, for me, I come down on that pro safety. And when I talk to people, almost universally, everyone agrees. Yeah, I'm pro safety. I want my kids and my daughters to be safe. My wife, I want them to be safe. So for me, I think that we've done some bad messaging.
Well, and in fact, if you look at things like Pew Research, and they've done a lot of surveys on abortion, and, you know, again, the media makes it out that we're so divided as a nation on the issue of abortion. But in fact, what the research shows is that about 14% of the people in this country think there should never be any abortions ever for any reason. About 14% of the people think that there should be no restrictions on abortion for any reason. The rest of the people think would consider themselves pro-choice to an extent, up to with some restrictions. And, you know, the battle goes, where are those restrictions? That's a discussion we should be having.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the really ironic thing about this discussion is, if you said 22 weeks and, you know, with no restrictions, and then after that with all of the proper exemptions for a woman's life and such, and that perfectly legal under Roe versus Wade, it was also the Catholic Church's official position for almost 300 years, from 1590 to 1870. That was their official position on abortion.
Interesting. And so, if you did the polling, did you ask the question of how many people think, you know, we want old white guys in government deciding what women get to do? What would that polling look like?
Yeah, we didn't ask that question, but yeah.
But here's the thing.
But even, you know, I think, Rick, even among women, most women would call themselves pro-choice, but do believe there should be some regulations laid on late-term pregnancies.
Sure.
But the thing that was
posed is, you know, because I know people who believe that when my wife was, you know, pregnant and we were racing to the hospital at 100 miles an hour, that when we got there, the doctor looked up and go, okay, which way are we going with this? Are we bringing it out, or are we wiping it out? That they believe that that's possible.
Yeah. And that's because we're doing such a horrible job of talking about the issue.
Yeah.
And, you know.
But here's the thing, and this is where Democrats,
again, let me just say, it is really interesting, I think, because I think there were five or six states in this last election that had referendums on abortion. And with the exception of Florida, because you needed 60% there, but the other states, the referendums that was more on the pro-choice side passed. And they passed in those states with a majority of the Catholic vote, while at the same time, Trump won those states with a majority of the Catholic vote. So abortion isn't really the issue that the Democrats pretend, or the others, everyone pretends it is.
So let me move this back to the future then. Because, you know, Democrats do need Catholic voters. They need religious voters. This one big, beautiful nightmare bill that's literally going to take food out of the mouths of children. Shouldn't this be? I mean, I've said this is the anti-Jesus bill. It's, you know, we're kicking the poor and enriching the wealthy. Shouldn't this be a great messaging tool to go, look at where are your values and look at what you did? Especially because I've talked about the big huddle that I remember seeing of Republicans praying before they passed this nightmare. I don't know what they were praying for, because because this isn't what I learned as a kid.
Yeah, and absolutely. And that's, you know, it's one thing for somebody like me to be given that message out there as a Catholic leader. And, you know, people expect that. And I get attacked a lot by the Catholic right. And so people expect that kind of a message from me of looking at this. But it's the message that our politicians should be giving, that this is not this is not what a good Christian person would be supporting. As a Christian, I could never support this kind of thing. And again, you know, part of the issue is we get so wrapped up in this separation of church and state, and we forget that separation of church and state doesn't mean that I, as a person, can't consider faith when I'm voting. It just means that the state can't impose a church on me. But it doesn't mean that I can't look at candidates and say, well, this person has my same moral and ethical values, so that's who I want to vote for. Yeah. But the Democrats are so afraid to, you know, talk about their faith. And not all of them. Again, I've heard AOC, I've heard Rosa talk about it and talk about it passionately. But most of them are just afraid to talk about their faith. I remember having a conversation with a woman who ran for Congress in Massachusetts. We were doing a training session for them. And she, you know, in this training, talked about her parents' faith and how much that. And I said to her, have you ever talked about that out on the campaign trail? And she said, oh, no, I wouldn't feel comfortable talking about that. I said, are you kidding me? That's what people want to hear.
Yeah, but here's the thing. I grew up believing you didn't proselytize. You didn't wear it on your sleeve. Your faith, that was personal. That you didn't go out and impose that on others. But you know, my evangelical friends, that's part of their mission. So it's not surprising to me that they've out organized and out, you know, out fundraised. Not surprising.
Well, they've out organized because they've raised hundreds of millions of dollars. They have wealthy conservative Catholics who contribute millions and millions and millions of dollars to conservative Catholic organizations who then go out and attack. I mean, they're attacking Governor Newsom right now over and over about his Catholic faith. And because they think he's the leading contender in a few years. Sort of
while
really
defending Donald Trump.
Yeah. But they're just attacking these Catholic people. And because they have the money to do that, the Democratic Party, you know how much money they spent on to organize Catholic voters in 2024? Zero, not a penny. Now, two things about, I'm a writer, I write a lot, and I wrote this article, I think it was around June. Jim Jordan, you know, our really, you know, wonderful congressman from Ohio, came out and is the chair of a committee, and he issued a report, and he said he was gonna subpoena organizations that were involved in climate work, particularly those that are involved in divesting, trying to get corporations to divest. And the organizations he was going after were Catholic sisters, the Sisters of Mercy, the Sisters of the Franciscan Sisters, other Catholic sisters. And Jim Jordan said they were destroying, they're part of a woke cartel that is destroying the American way of life. He's talking about Catholic nuns saying this. I wrote an article about it. It was published. You know, some people maybe read it. Yeah. National Catholic Reporter wrote an article about it, how terrible this was. I sent my article over to the campaign. I sent it to DNCC. I said, here's an example of Jim Jordan being anti-Catholic bias. Why aren't you jumping all over this? And I didn't hear a peep back from them.
So last question I've got for you, you know, what's the message for Democrats? If there's hope for the Democratic Party to get faith voters back, what's the message?
I think the message is that, first of all, they can't be afraid to talk about their faith and how they're formed, their politics are formed by their faith and what that faith means. It's not about I'm trying to impose my faith on you, but I'm trying to live my faith. And, you know, there's that old Catholic song, they'll know we are Christians by our love. So I try to live my faith. My faith is not about going to church on Sunday. It's about what I do every single day. And that's the message that we got to start. They have to start getting out. They have to start talking to people who work in Catholic world. They have to start understanding how to talk with Catholics. They don't have a clue about how to talk to Catholics. And they don't bring anybody. They don't talk to anybody who's actually worked in Catholic. They have, you know, a number of Catholic politicians, but they're not. They're politicians who happen to be Catholic. People like me, I mean, I ran the Franciscan Action Network. I co-founded the Global Catholic Climate Movement. I've been working as a progressive Catholic leader for 25 years now. And there's others like me out there that would love to sit down with these people and say, here's what you have to do. My friend Doug Padgett that I mentioned, he'd love to do that. He's an evangelical. He would love to sit down and say, here's how we, you know, let's work together to come up with a message, to figure out what the message is. How do we get that message across? But you know, they're afraid to do that. They won't do that. And they won't help raise money to get the message out. Again, coming from the politicians, Catholics aren't going to really pay a lot of attention to it. Coming from people like me or Simone Campbell or folks like that, they're going to pay a lot of attention to it.
Yeah, I love Sister Simone. We've had her on the show over the years. She does great work. I love the Nuns on the Bus tour. I love that. But, Patrick, I appreciate the time. Keep up the fight. Keep up the faith. I appreciate it.
Yeah, and I'm happy to come back at any time to talk more about this.
Good stuff. Thanks so much, Patrick. Patrick Carolyn, co-chair of Catholics Vote Common Good. Check out the website, votecommongood.com. Want to hear your thoughts. Is he right? Something catch your attention? And what should Democrats be doing? How do they get faith voters back? Want to hear your thoughts. Rick at the RickSmithShow.com. Quick break. Right back.
You're listening to Lake Air, WLAK. Amory's home for Nightlight with Pete Schwabe.
Local news, weather, and sports on air and streaming on the Civic Media app. This is the Civic Media Radio Network.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, mostly sunny and a high around 78. 55 tonight, mostly sunny on your Sunday with highs in the upper 70s. 78, mostly sunny on Monday. Tuesday, mostly sunny with highs in the low 80s, mid-80s Wednesday.
It's 73 at our studios.
I'm Rick Smith, host of The Rick Smith Show. If you're looking for honest talk, real stories, and straight-up news that matters to you, tune in to The Rick Smith Show. We're digging into the issues that affect your job, your family, your future. Join me weeknights at 9 on the Civic Media Radio Network because your voice deserves to be heard. That's The Rick Smith Show, heard weeknights at 9 right here on the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So we've been talking about for some time the assault on workers and the assault on regulation. Because remember, our Republican friends love to say, job-killing regulations! And there's not a regulation that they're thrilled with. I always throw back on that. Well, what about the people killing lack of regulation? And I look at what's going on in coal country, as Trump has said, we're going to bring coal back again. But we're cutting MSHA, we're cutting OSHA, we're cutting NIOSH, we're cutting everything that might keep those miners safe. And the investments that Biden was making into those areas seems like BS to me. And here to share some thoughts on just what this might look like and, well, how bad it's going to be, I've asked Jason Walsh to come talk with us. Jason's the executive director of the Blue Green Alliance. You can check out their website, bluegreenalliance.org. Jason, thanks for taking time for us.
It's a pleasure to be here, Rick.
So, you know, all during the campaign, we heard, you know, we're going to make coal great again. It's going to be great. West Virginia is going to be just teeming with jobs, and Virginia and all those coal states, it's going to be great. And yet what we're seeing out of this administration is they're gutting, you know, mine safety regulations, health programs, going after these different things. How do these things jive? How does this make any sense?
Well, it doesn't make sense if you pay attention, right? I mean, big picture, as you just named, I mean, this is in some ways a replay, maybe a more brazen one, of the first Trump presidency, right, where he promised to bring back coal jobs, Trump digs coal, et cetera, and at the end of his administration, we had fewer coal mining jobs than we did at the start of the administration. What we're seeing now, you just said it, right, is an attack on the existing infrastructure, government run, but in alliance with a whole bunch of stakeholders to track and protect the health and safety of coal miners, right? So there was an attempt to close over a dozen MSHA field offices. That was pulled back, but the complete destruction of NIOSH, right, the National Institute for Occupational and Safety and Health Administration, which is housed at the Department of Health and Human Services under now RFK Jr., which is basically the research arm of MSHA, right? They're the ones who test all the respirators for coal miners, right? All of that kind of stuff. That's been dismantled entirely, right? And so the Trump administration actually used that as an excuse to delay probably the most important new standard that was promulgated during the Biden administration, which was the silica standard, which for listeners who are don't track this closely, is essential because we are basically dealing with a new epidemic of black lung disease in the coal mines, right? After we came close to eradicating it in the 1990s. And that is primarily because as coal gets harder and harder to mine, and as we have more and more powerful equipment, coal operators are cutting through quartz and sandstone to get to the coal. And that is kicking up a lot of silica dust, and it's getting in miners' lungs, and it's causing black lung disease, which is a death sentence, right? And so the new silica standard was intended to actually protect the miners from getting that disease. That is on hold. We hope it's not on permanent hold. I will note that six Republican members of Congress sent a letter to the Secretary of Labor today asking them to kill that standard. So to me, this is only the start of what will be an aggressive campaign by the coal industry and their courtiers in Congress, if I can use that word, to kill the implementation of the standard.
So to what end? I mean, ultimately, you know, if the miners get sick, don't they, isn't there some recourse? Don't they have to get health care from somewhere? Who foots that bill? Because I know it's not the coal operators. I know they're fine. But isn't this, isn't there some disinterest here? Isn't there some negative for we, the taxpayers, to allow this?
Yeah. I mean, look, we still have the Black Lung Disability Trust Fund. Coal operators still have to pay into that. That was extended during the Biden administration. It was not killed in the one big, very ugly bill that was just passed and signed into law. So that is a bit of good news. But yeah, I mean, coal miners who get sick or injured or who are killed on the job, not only is there a direct and horrible impact for them and their families, but the rest of us as taxpayers pay for that, given the amount of federal investment in healthcare for coal miners and retirees that we've still managed to maintain in this country.
So let me be cynical for a moment, because, they're killing NIOSH. Aren't they the arm that keeps track of all this stuff?
Yeah.
You're killing the data collection. So you're saying that we're basically making black lung great again. If there's no one, and I guess this is the bear in the woods thing, if there's no one keeping track of it, if there's nobody doing the work of monitoring this, is it really happening?
I think there will be public servants remaining at MSHA who will keep doing the best they can. And certainly folks in states doing the best they can. But as you just said, I mean, what the Trump administration is trying to do is to dismantle the programs and systems we have in place to track what is happening, and use that data to keep not only coal miners safe, but the communities in which coal is extracted safe and healthy. I mean, look, just to boil it down, Trump has always loved to use coal miners as political props, but doesn't seem to particularly care whether they are alive or dead, healthy or sick. He loves to use coal communities as a backdrop for political theater, but he sabotages every effort to support the people who live there and to create a sustainable future in these places, including in the budget bill that was just signed into law.
No, and the reason I'm glad you brought that up is, look, Biden made some huge investments into those regions. And I know a lot of my lefty friends were saying, well, why are we investing in those states when, what about us? And it seems, even when Biden said, here, we're going to give you these new, this next generation of employment, you've now got Trump pulling that investment back. And it seems like, it seems like we're going again back to the future.
Yeah. Biden operated under the outdated notion that he was the president of all Americans in red states and blue states, Republican or Democrat or independent. And as you just noted, the Inflation Reduction Act was designed to drive investment to parts of the country, most importantly, coal communities that have experienced more economic pain than economic gain from the clean energy transition, right? And specifically, there is a bonus to much of the investment is driven by tax credits, as you know, Rick, and there's a bonus tax credit that an extra 10% bonus tax credit for most of the tax credits that basically gives the people who draw the businesses, the developers who draw down that tax credit, more public investment if they do projects, if they build projects in coal country. That was an enormous step that we considered historic. What has happened now is that congressional Republicans and the Trump administration have dramatically scaled back and repealed those clean energy investments, which makes that energy communities, coal communities bonus much less valuable, in some cases totally worthless.
Right. So like programs like what? The Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund, the Clean Energy Tax Credit, the Interagency Working Group on Coal Communities, those kind of things, gutting that. I don't know how that's supposed to help those regions, but that's what's happening.
Yeah, it's not. And I don't think they're trying to make any pretense of it. They're just hoping people don't pay attention, which is why your show and good reporting is so essential, because this is a scam, right? Let's be really clear about this. It is a scam. We have just basically taken over $500 billion of investment in clean energy and clean manufacturing, that most of which will go to create blue collar jobs, right? For construction workers, for manufacturing workers, for utility workers. And to add insult to injury, they have taken that money to use to pay for tax cuts for the wealthiest Americans. Now, an interesting little detail that people in coal country should know, they actually added one small provision. Was one of the only things they actually added other than repealed to the Advanced Manufacturing Production Tax Credit, which was set up to incentivize the manufacturing facilities that are building like batteries, solar, wind in this country. They added a provision that would give a production tax credit to metallurgical coal. Now, maybe I would be more patient with this if it was actually, it would have done something to, I don't know, provide some incentive to coal operators to invest more in their workers, invest more in their communities. But no, this is small. It's like 2.5% of a tax rate, only for 5 years. Basically, and by the way, metallurgical coal, 3/4 of it, we export. You know who our biggest customers are?
China
and India.
Yeah.
Right. So it's the equivalent of basically writing a check to the coal industry. That's basically what it is.
And are we surprised by this? I mean, you know, look, yeah, I hear all these stories, and there's so much of the pendulum swinging to the side of corporate interests and away from workers and making lives of working people worse. This is just another one in a long line of stories of this administration doing just that.
Yeah, no surprise, but we should know what they're doing and we should be angry about it.
No, and we should be angry about it is the part that I'm hoping, the reason we keep talking about it, because look, as I said on election night, the solutions for our problems are going to come out of the suffering caused by their savagery. We're seeing what they're doing is pure savagery, and it's going to cause a lot of suffering. Maybe not right now, this moment, but very soon Lives are going to get worse. Families are going to struggle. You're going to lose homes. We're going to lose the ability to put food on the table. Breadwinners, bad things are coming. And it's that that's that anger and then that will to organize that I'm hoping comes out of that.
Amen, brother. The only other piece I'd add here, right, is that the sum total of all of this, right, you know this, right? Coal communities, coal workers, they need investment. They need support. This shift is happening because customers are demanding cheaper and cleaner forms of energy, right? That's what they're demanding. They're not demanding new coal-fired power plants. What Trump is giving them is denial, false hope, and a hell of a lot more pollution, right? Denial of climate change, denial of global market trends, complete denial of reality. That's not going to help anybody.
So I guess the question I've got is how do we move to the policies that I thought Biden was doing very well, moving us, you know, in a better direction, moving towards some cleaner, greener kind of energies, some different transportation. Now we've got this pendulum swing back without really the I don't see the benefits here other than just paying off a couple of coal operators and destroying for purely political means. Any ability to deal with the coming crisis that is our climate?
Yeah, there are no benefits. What we do at this point is to hold policymakers accountable, particularly those who profess to actually care about the future of coal communities and coal workers, and do our best to kick them out of office and replace them with people who are actually representing their districts fairly.
So last question I've got for you then, because, you know, ultimately, this is a political issue. You know, the markets aren't deciding this. The politics are. So what's the answer here? What should people be doing? I get a lot of folks, you know, every day sending me emails. What do I do? What action should we take? People are saying write letters to the editor and make phone calls. And I'm like, I don't know. Maybe go ahead. I still think the number one way to get action, boots on the ground, in the streets, showing up and being accountable, but I want to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, no, I mean, look, my response is we need to organize. Don't mourn, organize, right? And organizing can take many different forms, as you know. It can be organizing your shop, organizing for a first contract fight, organizing your community. Whole bunch of different ways in which organizing can take place. But it is more necessary now than arguably at any point, certainly in my life, right? Where we have a president who really wants to act more like a dictator, right? Who is pulling from the authoritarian playbook that Putin in Russia, Orban in Hungary, and other authoritarians around the world have used. And the best response to authoritarians is getting people in the street and building broad big tent coalitions that say this is unacceptable.
No, absolutely. Because look, I don't want coal country to suffer. I don't want them to go down. I was like, okay, we're giving them these industries. Good. They need it to get away from this. Because look, a number of years ago, we did a labor history tour that took us into coal country. And long story really short is we had a bunch of coal miners who confronted us while we were down talking about the Battle of Blair Mountain. And the guy said, look, you know, coal's all we've got. Yeah, the coal companies are horrible. Yeah, it's not great, but it's all we've got. And by going, look, you know, we're going to move to other industries, give other opportunities. I thought it was the right thing to do. And now you've got the guy who's going to make coal great again, pulling all of that out from underneath them, ensuring that that's all they've got.
Yeah, exactly. And therefore easier to exploit.
Yep. No, it's that simple. Jason, I appreciate the time. Always great talk with you. I hope you'll come back and share some more thoughts down the road. Give us some good news. Good news next time, I hope.
Okay. Let's plan for it. Thank you, Rick. Always a pleasure to be here.
Thanks so much, Jason. Jason Walsh, Executive Director of the Blue Green Alliance. Check out their website, bluegreenalliance.org. Going to take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1917. Frank Little, an activist for the Industrial Workers of the World, or Wobblies, was lynched near Butte, Montana. His beaten body was found hung off a railroad trestle. On it was pinned a disturbing note. It read, quote, "Others take notice. First and last warning. 3777LDCSSWT. The numbers were the measurement of a grave. Each letter was the initial of a union organizer. The letter L for Frank Little was circled. The warning was clear. Union organizers leave town or die. Butte was copper mining country, and efforts to unionize the miners had turned the area into a battleground. Frank had arrived that July to help in the efforts to support striking miners. Frank Little was a leader of the IWW with experience organizing free speech campaigns, lumberjacks, and miners. Although not much is known of his early life, it is thought his mother was Cherokee and his father was a Quaker. He organized the wives of the miners to join in the pickets and helped build solidarity between the multiple unions that organized in the area. The Anaconda Mining Company took note of his presence, but could not find a legal means to stop him. Then, early on that fateful day, men came to his boarding house. They claimed they were police officers. They gagged Little and stuffed him into a car. They beat him and drug him through part of town tied to the car bumper. And it was at the county line where they hung Frank Little's body. News of the atrocity spread far and wide. Thousands attended the funeral. Not surprisingly, the authorities never found his murderers. Some doubt they ever tried. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
I gotta tell you, talking to Jason reminded me of the trip that we took back in 2013 when we did our labor history tour across the country, and we ended up going into southern West Virginia, and our goal was to talk about the Battle of Blair Mountain, like I said, and I remember vividly the day. It was a beautiful day, and the guy who was going to give us the tour said, "Understand, you know, we're going into trouble. You understand that, right? Because the trees are watching." And we're in the middle of literally nowhere. It's like someone just dropped you in the middle of the forest, and there you were. And we showed up to this kind of like fork in the road, this where there's an old rundown gas station that used to be a gas station, just an abandoned building now, and everything else just trees, a cement slab. Didn't know what it was for. It was for the train that had come through back during that time. But within like 15 minutes of us getting there, kind of unpacking our stuff to start recording and doing some stuff, cars came out of nowhere. And it was like we were surrounded immediately by like 30 cars. And out these folks came, to confront us about, what are you doing here? And we're literally in the middle of nowhere. And all of them having their Friends of Coal paraphernalia on. Big belt buckles, hats, shirts, bumper stickers all over their cars. The guys got sidearms. It was, for my wife and kids, it was a frightening moment. And I picked out the biggest guy, walked up to him and said, "What are we doing? How can I help you?" And thus began the conversation. And when they realized that I wasn't going to scare easy, they then came up with an alternative reason for being there. They were a trash pickup crew. And I'm going, curious why you decided here now. And the whole thing was thwarted by my five-year-old who goes, "Well, if you're picking up trash, where are your bags?" And they all kind of looked at each other like... But in that moment, I had the opportunity to begin a dialogue with these guys, because all of the men who were there worked for coal companies, the coal companies that were going broke, that were stealing their union pensions, or trying to break their union pensions, trying to steal their health care. Because in that moment, they were consolidating the union mines, the union companies into one, so they could bankrupt Patriot Coal. And And I remember at the time talking to these guys going, how do you feel about this? And they kept coming back to, you know, we're hoping that the union does is able to fight this off. We're hoping that some legislators help us. It was all wish and hope. And they kept coming back to, it's all we've got. And they understood their history. They understood that company towns were bad for them. They understood that company script was bad for them. They understood that the coal companies paid pathetic wages for decades and raped the ground of all of the wealth that was the citizens, that was their wealth, the wealth that they dug up and created. But it didn't trickle down to them. And they did it in dangerous working conditions. Those guys went into those mines knowing, today I may not see my family again. Or I may end up, as Jason pointed out, black lung is on the rise again. I may end up not just me getting it, but bringing something home that's going to harm my family. Because understand, their clothes full of it. And we have an administration that wants us to move us back to the good old days of no regulations. Back where, you know, you run coal, don't worry about those safety timbers or don't worry about any of that. And for any of those union agitators, they would hire private detectives, company police forces, so they could intimidate, harass, even harm. And miners who had the audacity to not wear the Friends of Coal, to not chip in for the lobbying efforts to keep, well, coal in the hands of the barons, well, they'd get blacklisted. They'd get fired. And in this day and age, while they don't live in company towns anymore, the bank still owns their home. No job, no payment, no home. Not much has changed. And not, especially in coal country, not a lot has changed in the whole master-servant relationship. It's basically indentured servitude. But again, I come back to, these folks are like, oh, look, we know it's bad. And they at the end, and this is why I talk to people who I don't agree with or don't agree with me, because I do believe working people can find and do understand common ground. And by the end, I was trying to get them on board with the idea of, one, coming on the show and talking about it. None of them would. Because look, they're in an environment where they get singled out, kind of a death sentence. But understood, our politics were part of this. And when the coal boss is in bed with whoever the politician is, does that help? You know, the thing I remember about the Battle of Blair Mountain, a million shots were fired in this employer miner coal war. They were literally dropping bombs out of planes onto these striking workers. And in the place that we were in, it's amazing. They had literally eviscerated the town. In a place where you had 10,000 miners striking, you would think there would be some infrastructure. 10,000 people got their supplies, got their entertainment, got their meals, got their, you know, whatever. You would think that there would be a town. It was systematically dismantled and moved. There was nothing there. And when we went in 2013, they were attempting to take the freaking mountain because they wanted to do mountaintop removal, get rid of it all entirely. Fortunately, there was a push to make it a national monument, and as I understand, that has happened. But understand, there's no lengths that these folks, these moneyed interests, won't go through to continue their dominance over we, the working people. And what do we keep doing? Well, we keep screwing those people because Biden said, hey, we're going to get you some other jobs, some other ways to support your family. So coal isn't the only thing. And Trump saying, nope, coal, it's the only thing for you. Let that sink in, coal, my coal country friends. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Miss any portion of the program, make sure you grab the podcast. Wherever you get your favorite podcast, you'll find ours. And as always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. At rick@thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
You're listening to Lake Air 1260 AM WLAK Amory and 107.5 FM W298DK Amory, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Chuck Sievertson. The Office of Special Counsel confirms it has opened an investigation into former Special Counsel Jack Smith and whether he violated the Hatch Act through his criminal investigations into President Trump. The Hatch Act prohibits government employees from engaging in partisan political activities. An escalating trade war sparks new stagflation fears. That's when the economy slows while prices rise. Investopedia editor Caleb Silver.
At some point, consumers are going to stop spending if prices rise too high. And we've already seen inflation kind of being very sticky around the 2.6, 2.7% range.
The man law enforcers are looking for in yesterday's shooting at a bar in Anaconda, Montana, Michael Brown, lived next door to the Owl Bar.